Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners, to our little wireless program. Later, we'll be taking an unsentimental look at The Sentimental Bloke and its famous author, C.J. Dennis, who was, in his day, the richest poet in Australia and one of the most famous, indeed, on earth. But first, we're looking at a refugee crisis. Now, as you know, I've had a central preoccupation with this issue as long as I can remember, but it was kindled before the Tampa crisis, which occurred, would you believe, exactly 13 years ago. Ever since then, we've been shoving asylum seekers behind razor wire, including women and children, and treating these sad people as though they were represented a great and urgent danger to this country. And we're talking about a handful of people. Imagine how our various prime ministers of both major parties would feel if they had to deal with the issue that now confronts and bedevils Barack Obama. In what has fast become a humanitarian crisis, bar none, about 50,000 kids have fled their home in Central America, sent north by their parents to the supposed safe sanctuary of the U.S., at home in Mexico, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, the gang-related violence has become such a threat to the lives of children that the U.S. Looks like the best option. Not that the welcome mat has been rolling out, because the influx has, intensified an already powerful, overpowering immigration debate within America. Joining me now from Boston is Tiago de Araguaia. Tiago is a regular columnist for the Brazilian News Group and director of the Latin American Political Risk Analysis. Adam Isaacson is senior associate for regional security and policy in Washington, D.C., and joins me on Skype. Gentlemen, I welcome you both to Late Night Live. Adam, 90,000 kids are expected to have arrived in the not-too-distant future. Americans are arguing that there's always been violence in those Central American countries. Why is this exodus taking place now? What's the answer to that?
I suppose there are two answers to that. The first, the exodus really began around 2012 because of a spike in violent crime and in the homicide rate in the three countries of Northern Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. And while, as you say, it's always been a violent region, homicide rates rose to levels even higher than Iraq before the so-called surge. So people started coming just because of the threats they were getting, particularly from street gangs, extortion, kidnapping, forced recruitment, rape. And as they came, it became evident that thanks to a law that was passed unanimously in the United States at the end of 2008, children who arrived unaccompanied from these countries that don't touch the United States could actually were automatically put into a judicial proceeding, which meant that they could stay here, often for as many as a year or two or more, while awaiting a decision from these courts. And probably, we don't know for sure, but probably word of that got out, that you could be reunited with your family while you awaited your judicial proceeding if you were an unaccompanied child. And due to that, starting around January of this year, the arrivals from Central America, which were already increasing rapidly, shot up to levels that nobody could have predicted. And as a result, you've had, just since October, just from those three countries in Central America, about 50,000 people.
Adam, I was talking about the appalling conditions in which Australia chooses to hold asylum seekers for due process or a complete lack thereof. What are the conditions for these children when they get to the United States?
When they get to the United States, the first thing that happens is actually there's no sort of pursuit. The Border Patrol, which is our 20,000 strong force along the border, will detain them, and they seek to be detained. By all accounts, the children across the border, almost all of them in the southern tip of Texas, they seek out the Border Patrol. They're detained. Upon their detention, Border Patrol has 72 hours to process them, often in these concrete cells that are completely overcrowded. They're not built for this sort of thing. And then hand them over to our Office of Refugee Resettlement, which has also been overwhelmed by the flow. The ORR is supposed to find a place for these children that is sort of the best possible and safest conditions without detention being the least favorable option. And so if they can find a relative, they let them stay with a relative, giving them a notice to appear in immigration court, which could be for months from now because the courts are so overwhelmed.
We'll return to this part of the story in just a few moments, but I want to bring Tiago into the discussion. Tell me about the Northern Triangle. Tell me about El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, in the sense that these are countries that seem to have abandoned their children and mortgaged their future.
Well, these countries are countries that are still suffering from the effects of their civil wars from the 80s. The violence that we see today in this country, they are a continuous story from back then. Obviously, we can find during the 90s some moments in which violence wasn't as exaggerated as it is today and as strong and deep as it is today. But mainly, these has always been unsafe countries and countries that offered their own society all types of unsafety and doubt for the future.
Tiago, I think it's fair to say that to some extent, or to a large extent, these countries in the triangle are also victims of US-recommended neoliberal policies, which has intensified poverty, social exclusion.
Well, of course, yes, that's true. But I don't think that this could be used as a proper explanation or excuse on how situation came so deep in those countries. Because during the 90s, many countries throughout the region adopted similar models and then came to the crisis to the level of social tragedy that those three countries reached. Independently of the political model that a country chooses, the country is fully responsible for their own capability of implementing these models. A corrupt nation, a disorganized nation, a country where the elites do not support the national development, it could be Honduras, it could be Guatemala, it could be anywhere in the world, there would be a process of inequality led by those problems. If the neoliberal models from the 90s were well executed under a system that respected the rules, independent judicial system, and a full engagement of the local elites to the process, we would see something completely different today.
This is Alan Nell on RN, and my guests are Tiago de Aragao and Adam Isaacson. And I'll come back to you in a minute, Tiago. We'll continue your analysis. But, Adam, I understand that around 2012, the year before, the number of undocumented migrants fell to a 40-year low. So this latest wave must have come as a great shock to the U.S.
It has. We were not prepared for this. But it's worth noting that, you know, traditionally, most of the migration to the United States, usually about 90-plus percent of those whom our Border Patrol apprehends each year, come from Mexico. The number of people coming from Mexico, as you know, it fell to all-time lows in 2011, 2012, and continues to either fall or stay the same every year. There is no increase in arrivals from Mexico, and we're, in fact, facing a bizarre situation in which it's possible that more than half of those who are apprehended on the U.S. side of the border, of the Mexico border this year, will not be Mexican. Most will be Central American. So it's a shift that we've actually never seen before.
And I understand that some of the Mexican children, at least, are claiming to be from other countries because it's harder to send them back to far-flung El Salvador, for example.
the Mexican children may be claiming. That's possible. I don't think that happens in too many cases. It's very easy to test them. Sing your country's national anthem. What accent do you speak Spanish with? Just name the president of your country. There's a lot of just basic questions that they're not studied up on.
Yeah, okay. So back to you, Tiago. Let's focus on Honduras. The highest murder rate, especially in the age group between 30 and 44. Tell us about Honduras.
Oh, Honduras is a country in Central America in which, since the Civil War of the 80s, was not able to get back to its feet in terms of social organization. It's a country in which the inequality is visible in most of its cities. You find San Pedro Sula, a city hundreds of kilometers away from the capital, in which the murder rates are incredibly high. According to the last pieces of information, it's considered one of the highest murder rates in the world.
Well, it's roughly 35 times the U.S. average, and that's pretty high by global terms.
Exactly. So this city represents directly the failure of Honduras as a country to assemble a society capable of developing a nation. And San Pedro Sula shows all the areas and traits of the recent history of Honduras. It is a perfect example where you can still find examples of the failed civil war of the 80s, examples of the minimum thrive of commercial thrive of the 90s, plus the inequalities that were product of the 90s, and today as a home base of major gangs that understood that what they used to do in other countries before arriving in Honduras could be potentialized to almost controlling the city and the country using San Pedro Sula as their home base.
Now, I understand from your writings that the high murder ratio creates a domino effect because teenagers from the families are then forced to choose sides between drug gangs. Tiago, let me ask you this. Given that you're describing a country which is not so much a state as a failed state, is there an energy within Honduras to get back into some semblance of a decent nation?
There is, because basically the relationship today between those gangs and the police and judicial forces in Honduras is a situation of fully surprised. Because you have those police forces, they are also surprised on how quick the violence escalated in their own country. Plus, this organization, they always have functioned in an amateur form of police form. And third, high corruption rates. Corruption is embedded inside the police forces in Honduras. So you have three elements, not only in the police forces, but in the entire judicial system, that paves a fantastic way for those gangs to thrive. And the only chance of starting to revert this situation is by adjusting clear rules from the judicial system, because the judicial system of a country is what sends the signal and the message to society that the rules will be followed. And it creates a domino effect of trust and confidence in their own country from the elites, from the opinion makers, from the decision makers, all beginning from how the judicial system operates.
Adam, let's come back to the 50,000 kids, perhaps soon to be 90,000. They're given very basic accommodation. Are they being educated? Is their health being looked after? Or have the numbers overwhelmed a system which wasn't anticipating their arrival?
I think that the authorities in the United States are doing their best under these circumstances. Actually, the human rights community does not have a strong critique of how they're being treated once they're here. Certainly, the overwhelming conditions have composed, especially the first few days of their time here, to be miserable. And, of course, those whose family members cannot be located are being kept in military barracks and things like that while they search for better accommodations. And, of course, the Obama administration right now is trying to get out of Congress a couple of billion dollars to pay for this additional demand. But those, especially those who have been reunited temporarily with their family members who are here, even if they're not here legally, are being registered in schools. They are back with parents whom they haven't seen in a long time. And there's probably a lot of happy stories going on right now. But for the most part, still, it's not very well organized yet, just because it's something that's been happening just since about April.
Adam, it sounds as though the United States is doing a much better job with huge numbers than Australia has managed or bothered to do with its modest influx. Let's talk now about the politics of it with Obama. The Republicans, of course, are blaming the influx on his inability to protect the borders. How do you see it?
That is rather spurious. As we've noted, the border has seen less migration, way less migration. We're talking about 3,000 to 350,000 people a year who the Border Patrol is now apprehending. It used to be more than 1.5 million just 10 years ago. So that's not it. It is more, it's every political opportunity they can take to try to turn back attempts to reform our immigration system, which right now is just simply not working. There's something similar in Australia. There's very, very bitter national debates over migration, and a lot of these debates have racial overtones. And it's a legislative election year here in the United States. Those usually don't have huge turnout, and one way to turn people out is to get them angry about something.
Sure, make them afraid.
Oh, that's true. It's a great mixture, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, the Republicans are already pretty much seen as the anti-immigration party, but this is a dangerous game for them politically because, I assume Hispanic voters won't be that pleased.
Yeah, the Republican Party have a problem here. They do dominate one chamber of our two chambers of Congress, and they are trying to take back the Senate this year. And the way their districts are drawn for the House and the way you run for Senate, it's very local. And many of the districts that are Republican-dominated or have hope of turning to Republicans have a very small minority population. So they're running very hard against migrants, and they're alienating the Latino population in a very big way. They're going to pay for this in 2016 when we have a presidential election and the Latino bloc becomes a real key, ever more faster growing, decisive part of the electorate. So at the national level, this is going to cost them very dearly, although at the local level, at the legislative level, it may actually help them solidify a majority. It's a strange dynamic we're seeing right now.
Tiago, you write about a culture of economic violence in these countries where the rural and urban poor, the indigenous, are excluded from normal means of economic participation and are ruthlessly exploited by the system.
Exactly. And this is a historical event in Honduras, not only in Honduras, but in the other countries of that region. That's a historical event in which the differences between groups within the same country, they are always more accentuated in moments of crisis. And moments of crisis, when it comes with violence, they either bring up two solutions for individuals that belongs to the society. They either join the violence, often transforming this into a civil war. But for this to happen, you must have very clear sides of who's whom in order to attract population to that. Or the exodus, in which the violence is provoked by groups that do not have a legitimate reason in the eyes of certain people from the society, or do not represent them in any way at all. And this provokes a social convulsion that leads to a further to accentuating every problem that the country has.
Adam, I know we're about to lose you because you have to go and pick up a child of your own. Might I ask you just one question? How is the Mexican government dealing with Washington at the moment on this issue?
Well, the Mexican government is under heavy pressure from Washington to do more to stop the flow. And, you know, Mexico actually does detain on its own about 80 to 90,000 Central Americans a year. The United States is leaning on Mexico, though, to really close or seal its border with Guatemala to an extent it never has bothered or needed to do in the past. And President Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico has announced some measures to do more there. And in fact, there's been vague promises even to try to keep Central Americans from riding the northbound trains that go through Mexico. They sit on top of the cargo trains and go toward the U.S. border by the thousand. So we're going to see some crackdown in Mexico, but we're not seeing a crackdown in Mexico on what really matters, which is the corruption, which has allowed those who prey on the migrants as they go through Mexico to thrive. As many as 20,000 Mexicans, Central Americans passing through Mexico get kidnapped for ransom by people who prey on migrants.
And Adam, I'm feeling guilty.
To stop it.
Adam, I'm feeling guilty. For heaven's sake, go and grab your kid. And thank you very much. It dramatizes, I think, the subject we're discussing.
Thanks, Adam.
Back to you, Tiago. Is it true that, to some extent, the gang culture you're describing was learned, indeed, in the U.S., in areas like Los Angeles?
Exactly. And this demonstrates a very paradoxical situation from what we're living today. During the 80s, during the Civil War of the 80s, you had a huge outflow of Central Americans to the U.S., particularly to Los Angeles. And these Central Americans, the youth of those Central Americans that began their lives in Los Angeles, they faced a local situation, a street situation of exclusion, of social exclusion. Basically, coming from local Mexican-American gangs and African-American gangs from the streets of Los Angeles. It's important to point out that in the 80s, it was one of the heights of the moment of the gang movement in big cities in the United States, like Los Angeles. So the Central Americans, they started creating their own groups, basically to protect themselves from Mexican gangs and African-American gangs from the city. But as time went by, the power of the groups that they created allied with the brutality of how they protected themselves and started committing crimes around the areas in Los Angeles, transformed them into a powerhouse among the gangs. Years passed by, and these strong gangs in the region of Los Angeles, they began being expelled from the country by U.S. authorities and being sent back to their own countries from the past. Many of them arrived in Honduras and El Salvador for the first time in their lives or for the first time in 15, 20 years. And they brought in the same model of violence that they had created in L.A., but with the benefit for them that instead of the tough reprehension from the police and the judicial forces in the United States, they found a very fertile ground with basically no pressure at all from police forces in their own countries.
You know, we're talking about very young refugees, but we're also talking about very young populations. So Guatemala is like Gaza, a country of young people. 48% would be described as, you know, as children or adolescents. Yet Guatemala has the worst level in the region of government funds allocated for issues like education.
Exactly, and this is no surprise. This is no surprise. I've been to Guatemala a few years ago, and you literally find two types of Guatemala, especially in the capital. You find this small island of that everything works, the infrastructure is great, beautiful shops, beautiful streets, in which a very, very small parcel of the population benefits from this particular neighborhoods. And usually they're all linked with major political forces and business forces. And around this neighborhood, you have the entire country, millions and millions and millions of people in a situation that it's below the minimum of that they should be living with.
And Tiago, you make the powerful point in your writing that the only way to start to undo this problem is to see commitment by leaders, improving police, courts and jails, punishing corruption, expanding education and youth opportunities, collecting taxes to pay for all that. It's a big ask and it's not likely to happen.
No. And one important thing is that Latin Americans, they disobey weak forms of leadership and they strongly obey strong forms of leadership. So you can find examples throughout the country. Strong institutional leaderships, they're often very well respected and they receive the feedback from society while they are succeeding. But leaderships that are failed, weak, or corrupted, they receive a completely different form of reaction, of total abandonment. So the case is that there is a general feeling in countries like Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador that it's a lawless country, that nothing functions. So sometimes the fact that 80% of the institutions in the country are failed, but 20% functions in a decent form.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have to wind it up. Yeah. Most grateful for your contribution. Tiago de Araguello, director of the Latin American think tank Political Risk Analysis, and we've already said goodbye to Adam Isaacson, Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy for Washington Office on Latin America.